Hi, this is Phil Lairness, sitting alongside my wife, Lily Lairness. As we travel through the third decade of the 21st century, it's good to know that the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Editions continue to produce a minimum of 4 hours of weekly audio goodness on Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. Why do you have that glazed expression on your face, Lil?
Too many numbers in that announcement.
Don't forget your toothbrush. That used to be the line, and it seems that that is certainly something which applies to people's habits during the pandemic, especially when it comes to brushing your teeth, which is very important. And to actually talk about that, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals. First of all, the Chief Executive of the Oral Health Foundation, that's Dr. Nigel Carter, OBE. How are you, Nigel?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. We've also got a dentist from Oral-B as well. That's the wonderful Slade McGrath. How are you, Slade?
Hi, I'm very good, thank you.
Excellent. Actually, Slade, we'll come to you first. I mean, this is great news for dentists, isn't it? That oral hygiene is up to speed there. We're brushing our teeth regularly. It's helped us through with that regularity.
Absolutely. I think it's definitely a positive. I think we've seen a lot of changes over the last year and our routines have changed significantly. But one of the findings from the studies that we've done has found that oral health and toothbrushing hasn't changed drastically. And that's still what people are generally bookending their day with and starting their day with. So that's great news. There are definitely some improvements to be made on oral health still. We're definitely not at where we could be, but it's definitely great news that it's still kind of at the forefront of people's minds. And it's something that hasn't changed drastically over the last 12 months.
Now, you mentioned there about obviously the importance of brushing and working through that. Now, I've had this ongoing thing in which I'm not a flosser. I love the brush. I love brushing my teeth, etc. But flossing, which seems to be very popular in the 20th century, is something I've never quite sort of worked through on that basis. I mean, Nigel, in terms of flossing, is that a case of, oh, what a rebellion he is, what a rebel? Or should we still actually include flossing in our general oral health?
Well, I would say what we definitely need to include in our oral health routine is cleaning in between our teeth. You know, two out of the surfaces of the teeth are either side, and we need to be getting in there and cleaning that space. In the UK and in Europe, we tend to be recommending these little interdental brushes, the little bottle brushes. Oh. People find them much easier to use. Flossing has never taken off in a big way in the UK, and we reckon there's probably only about 5% of the population floss on a regular basis. If you are a flosser and you've mastered it, we would not say give up. By all means, carry on. But for those who are challenged, as you describe, in terms of getting into a flossing routine, try the little interdental brushes, and people tend to have much more success with those.
Okay. Then, of course, there's always the electric option, Slane. Is that something which, again, is much more of a possibility when we're sort of looking at, well, let's go electric, you know, forget all that manual labour?
Absolutely, as with everything else. Electric toothbrushes are proven scientifically to be significantly more effective in the removal of plaque than manual toothbrushes are. At the moment in the UK, about half of the population are using electric toothbrushes, and we'd like to see all of the population using them. They're also a lot more gentle on the dental tissues, on the enamel and on the gums. There's no real work involved with an electric toothbrush like there is a manual toothbrush. It does all the work for you. Whereas with a manual toothbrush, we often see overbrushing and over scrubbing causing recession of the gums and wear to the teeth themselves. The modern electric toothbrushes as well, the Oral-B range, connect to apps on your phone, and they show you how long you should be brushing for, what areas you've brushed and for how long for. So if there's areas that you're missing, it will tell you and show you that. So it should lead to a much more effective clean.
And Nigel, I see in terms of the results of this particular aspect, 55% of British folk are actually opting for electric brushing techniques, 43% are still opting for a manual brush. So it's getting fairly close in terms of the way in which we actually choose to apply those technologies.
Yes, it really is. And I mean, that's changed over the last decade or so. We would probably only have been talking about half that figure, so about a quarter of people using electric if we've been talking 10, 15 years ago. So we're moving in the right direction, because there is no doubt that you can remove more plaque with an electric toothbrush, particularly these with the little round oscillating heads. They're the ones that are proven to get the best plaque removal effect, and they're improving all the time. And if people have difficulty in following a routine, we've now got the apps associated with them, so you can take your mobile phone or your iPad into the bathroom and actually see the areas of your teeth that you're cleaning. So it's got more sophisticated. Than started off with a 2-minute timer, then we went down to 30 seconds so you could do a quadrant. Now you're actually looking at 16 different areas that the toothbrush can guide you around with the latest toothbrushes. So quite exciting to watch for the future, and a lot of emerging evidence that it does improve people's compliance. As a nation, although we say brush for 2 minutes twice a day, we know that people on average only brush for 45 seconds. So anything that we can do to extend that and get better plaque removal is going to pay benefits for people's oral health.
It's rather like the notion that with a mouthwash, I believe you're supposed to actually go for 30 seconds or so. I think most people are probably around about 15, 20 seconds, as opposed to the full 30-second watch. Slane, we're coming to the end of National Smile Month, I should say. Obviously, we want National Smile Year. A few years ago, there was a big concern that actually our British dental hygiene was really in a pretty sticky state of affairs. Do you think that actually things have improved markedly, and that, you know, it's not too long before we could say we're up to the standards of the best of California, if you wish?
Hopefully not too far away from that, but we still definitely have steps to take. There has been huge improvement in oral health over the years, and that's due to a number of factors such as fluoridation in the water and fluoride toothpaste and that type of thing, but people being more aware of it. I think certainly in the younger generations, because of the influences of the media, it has become a lot, people have become a lot more aware of oral health and oral hygiene, but also more conscious of the appearance of their smile. And I think when you're more conscious of the appearance of it, you're more inclined to spend the time making it look good. So I definitely think we're on the right track. We're not quite there yet, but there's definitely been significant improvements.
So, Nigel, where would you suggest people should actually go to find out more details about this particular survey and indeed choosing, obviously, electric toothbrushes and so on?
Go along to the National Smile Month website at smilemonth.org, and you can go along to the Oral-B website at oralb.co.uk for more information on the latest electric toothbrushes.
And Slane, would you also sort of suggest that sometimes it's good to actually ensure you actually look after your teeth after you've eaten as well, not just sort of morning and night, actually change and vary your schedule for brushing?
I think there's no harm in doing it. I think there's within reason. I mean, we don't need to be brushing our teeth after every meal, and you don't need to be brushing your teeth excessively. What we're aiming for is brushing twice a day for 2 minutes, the most important one being the evening brushing. And that's because overnight your saliva flow reduces. So any of the bacteria and the acid on your teeth is really getting to work overnight. And that's the time that most damage is caused. So having a really clean mouth going to bed is really important. And then generally it's recommended first thing in the morning as well for 2 minutes, but at least one other time throughout the day. So if we're reaching that, as dentists, we'll be really, really happy. If you're one of the people that does brush after lunch, fantastic. That's amazing. But if we could reach our 2 minutes twice a day, that's really what we're aiming for.
It's only 120 seconds. I mean, that's all it should put
that's all it is.
Quickly on that system. Slane McGrath, dentist from Oral-B, of course, and Dr. Nigel Carter, OBE, Chief Executive of the Oral Health Foundation. Huge thanks. I wouldn't say Happy Smile Month, because it should be Happy Smile Year, surely. So let's just keep smiling.
You've stolen my finishing line. That's what we want everybody to do, is have a nice smile, a healthy smile, and be able to keep smiling.
In her time working at the Eastern Daily Press, she had sometimes been allowed to report on the shows that the main critic was not particularly interested in. He had been a gentleman of advanced years who took himself very seriously. This meant that he reserved his attention for plays that were on the number one touring circuit and visits from prestigious companies such as Glyndebourne and Northern Ballet. He always critiques the big stars too, like Ken Dodd and Danny LaRue. But she had been allowed to cut her teeth on interviewing lesser productions and had felt she had truly arrived in the business when she was invited to press night drinks on Mondays. That thrill of being recognised as someone who wrote words for a living had been so potent she had never got used to it. Not my words, but the awesome words from around about page 100 of an absolutely fabulous text, which I actually devoured over the last couple of days. So many ways of loving. Of course, it's a hearty welcome back to our ace correspondent and writer and broadcaster, a general polymath of a female. It's Christine Weber. How are you, Christine?
Well, I'm really well. And thank you for reading a chunk of my book. That's so nice. And you did it so well.
Oh, Christine, I always like to ensure that we have a certain line of things. I mean, the closing line, though, I have to say, perhaps 2020 will bring fewer surprises. Neatly done. Neatly done. Well,
thank you. Yeah. Well, you know, that was a sort of what am I going to do about what has happened, you know? And then I thought, well, I'm not going to write about what has been happening. I've set it in 2019. But I think that kind of feeling that, oh, my God, we know something that they don't know is a bit of a cliffhanger to leave them on, isn't it, really? So thank you for picking that up.
Well, I've got to say, the way in which you have multiple narratives coming through the system, the characters that are actually introduced in an extraordinary setting to start off with, Jennifer, Monica, of course, Lucy. Oh, Lucy, don't eat that cake. Don't eat that cake. That's all I say. Treats, terrible results, eating all that sugar. It's an acronym. And sugar is the new nicotine. I won't go any further, but she has an interesting life story. But talking about interesting stories, let's introduce you fully to the team now, because as well as Rory McGowan, we've got our ace actor extraordinaire, Pirates of the Caribbean, the joys, of course, of the wonderment of Last of the Summer Wine. And I did get certain Last of the Summer Wine vibes, Christine, from your wonderful text, So Many Ways of Loving. It's Jonathan Lindsley. How are you, Jonathan?
I'm very well, thank you, Alexius. And hello, everybody. Thank you for inviting me along.
Well, there is a specific reason for that, Jonathan, and we'll come to it in a few seconds. But we've also got from Norwich, see what we're doing here, Christine, Gabriella Van Genians. How are you, Gabriella?
Hi, I'm good, thank you. And hi to everyone as well.
Excellent. Hi. And how appropriate to have somebody from Norwich. Quite a chunk of the book is set there, so that's really good.
Well, we like to ensure that's developed. Now, the other thing is, Jonathan, again, I think it's fair to say that you shared with us the fact that you lost the love of your life a few years ago. You've been operating as a widow. So, I mean, the book deals with loss. And Christine, obviously, you lost David Delvin, passed on from that for you. And I just want to say, Jonathan, from your own point of view, in terms of coping strategies with respect to that, I mean, it was a big shock. And you also act as a carer as well for France's sort of latter years as well. So it's an interesting journey that we all go on. I mean, I was in a sense, was I blessed? I mean, both my parents literally went like that. And it was a very sharp scenario. But I'm still, the potency is still there. Just share with us, Jonathan, is it still something, Christine in her book sort of says that he never goes away. From your own point of view, is that something that you carry with you as part of the human journey?
I would say so. I mean, I would say that you can see other people coping with this and you can get advice from people about how to deal with it and how devastating it is. But for me anyway, nothing prepared me for how I would feel. And I don't think you can be prepared. I mean, I think there's an element of preparedness in all of us, if you lose the next generation, parents, and but if you lose somebody who is either your partner or somebody younger, and it's a surprise and a shock. I mean, obviously, that's not very. The shock is very difficult to cope with. But the for me anyway, it was a journey that I didn't expect to go on, and. When I did, I had no coping strategies really, I think it was very helpful talking to other people who'd gone through the same experience. And I heard a lot of, and I read a lot of stuff. And I think I was lucky in the sense that now it's easier to find that information online rather than have to hunt through books and advice from doctors and therapists and people like that who obviously are helpful. And there are a lot of suggestions. I mean, you kind of think that you're going to feel strong, and you're going to get through it, and you're, you know, you and then of course it's for me anyway, the first, I suppose, 3 or 4 weeks, maybe even 3 or 4 months, I have very little memory of what happened. It just kind of wiped out, and I think I was acting on autopilot. I think I mean registering the death, all those things that you have to go through, sorting out insurances and finances and the bank and all that kind of stuff, and the will and the house and just everything, is extraordinarily overwhelming. And yet you can, I mean, I did get through it. Now the weird thing is I can't find any of the things that I either tidied away or put away from that period. I just don't know where they are in the house, and I would have to do another search, which would probably take me several months. It doesn't, I mean, yes, it's something you live with for the rest of your life. I don't think it's something that goes away. I think it's something you learn to manage and cope with. I think that's probably what grief is, effectively.
It's certainly something which, from my own point of view, I well remember back in 1994, Jonathan, when we were having, I think, a coffee several months after my mum had actually just passed away. And you said, as an only child, it's suddenly the spotlight is all on you. And like, what do we do now? You know, that kind of bounce back ability of actually having somebody you can actually kind of relate to. Suddenly, poof, it's gone. But it's another issue. Christine, I mean, we're not going to talk about bereavement and so on, but I just thought it was important to actually bring that up at this particular moment, because the book actually, it's a celebration of life as much as it is how we cope with the passage of loved ones as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I've tried to do is to more or less show that if we're lucky enough to live to be old, these are the things we cope with, and sometimes sooner than we were expecting. And I absolutely echo everything that Jonathan said, because when my own husband died, I mean, I knew for 18 months that he was going to die. And he used to say, "Are you going to be all right?" I go, "Darling, I'll be fine." You know, I sort of, because you're busy getting them over the finishing line, you're busy getting them the sort of, you're trying to make sure they have the sort of peaceful death that they want, and that's your job. And then, as you say, you've got so much to do in the funeral and everything, and it's much later that you think, oh, death really is forever. I mean, it's sort of like, oh, because I sort of think I had a fond, well, I don't think, you know, I think I had some sort of fond idea that he wouldn't be here, but I would feel his presence so strongly that it would be as good as him being there, almost. I think that's what I thought, which is bizarre, looking back. But maybe you just get through because that's what you want to believe, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting, Christine, that you did use the O word there. As I say, we don't talk about being old on the Midweek Drive. We are experientially enhanced or chronologically gifted. It's a minor point, but I feel in political correct terms, we need to work through that. Gabriella.
Well, it's like somebody said to me in an interview earlier today, something about, is it ever too late to do something? I went, we positive aging people never say anything's too late. It's never too late. You can always have a go. So, yes, I understand that. So I'm sorry. But I also do feel that when you get to be 74, which I am, you are actually allowed to sort of at least allude to the fact that you are older, but not old.
Exactly, but still a mere sprite when it comes to the Midweek Drive. I mean, as Gabriella, who's now in her 97th year, will attest to. Sorry, Gabriella. Let's turn to yourself.
What she's taking, clearly.
Exactly. Gabriella, any questions you'd like to put to either Christine or Jonathan at this moment?
Christine, I'd like to ask you about your book. Firstly, the front cover of your book, I love dogs. So I absolutely love the dog on the front cover. Like, without spoiling the book too much, can you tell me, like, a little bit about the dog?
I certainly will. He's a real dog. And he doesn't belong to me, alas. He belongs to two friends of mine. And I now live about 12 minutes drive from them, as it happens. He was a rescue dog. I mean, they've got several miniature schnauzers, but this was the only time they had a rescue dog. He's a white one, which is very unusual. And I did debate whether it was right to have him on the front cover, because, you know, suppose people hate dogs, you know, there are a few misguided people who feel that way. But he is quite seminal to the plot. He's very crucial in sort of somebody's recovery, you know, and also I just think that, you know, sometimes people get from a pet something that they can't get any other way. They can confide in a pet and they have that love, and it's another heartbeat in the house, and there's all sorts of things about it. So, yeah, so his real name is Hoagie, and I've called him Hoagie in the book. He was a rescue dog. When my friends got him, I just fell in love with this dog, and I keep saying, if you go away, you know, I could have him. And he's just lovely. And then I persuaded him through his very nice owners to model for the cover. So so that's that. So, yeah.
And named after Hoagie Carmichael, perchance?
Sorry?
Named after Hoagie Carmichael?
He was. Well spotted, he was. Yes. And their other dogs are called Ella, Louie, and what's the latest one? Peggy. So, yes,
yeah.
They're all jazz legends, yes.
I love the sequence when you're actually describing how Hoagie effectively desperately wants to actually go and spends the night in the bedroom of Jen, but she keeps saying, no, no, no. And in the end, of course, she just sort of makes a compromise, which I think works well. Nice little piece.
That's how life is with a dog, let's say. So, yeah.
Yeah, constant compromise. Yeah. Rory, what about yourself? Any thoughts from yourself?
I mean, Christine, I have to ask, as a creative writer myself, it's talking about widowhood and something as kind of challenging and deep and emotional as that being at the heart of the book. Is there anything that you were telling yourself throughout the writing process, or like reminding yourself of, to properly channel and do the justice that such a deep theme deserves?
That's a really good question. And actually, yes, a lot of my experience went in it, as you can imagine. And I did, during the sort of 2 years or 2.5 years, really, when my husband was ill, and then the sort of year following, because, as Jonathan says, you are kind of numb. I think you don't really know what's happening. I did every now and again record my thoughts or my dreams or things. So I did have those, and I would go back and think, oh, God, yes, and that dream upset me for the rest of that day, sort of thing. So, but a lot of it just spontaneously came because, you know, as we were saying, I don't think you lose it. But while we're on that subject, I think one of the ways that I was helped most was I did watch a little YouTube thing by a bereavement specialist. And I mean, so many of these things that you do, you just think, oh, I don't think that helps me at all, you know. But this particular thing did. And this woman said, you never forget this person. They're always central to your being. All that happens is you construct life around the space that they resided in. And I think that's such a good way of putting it, because, you know, you are going to laugh again and you are going to go out with friends and find, oh, I really enjoyed that evening. You know, I am going to work and I'm going to still get fulfillment from work, you know, but there's this sort of, there is a kind of void that is forever there, but you're constructing something positive around it. And also, I think at the same time, if you're very lucky to have had a wonderful relationship, as I did and my character has, that, you know, gradually, as the pain eases a bit, you can feel huge gladness that you were just so lucky to have that. So I tried to kind of have that infiltrate through the book as well, because I think it's a really important part of recovery.
Jonathan, anything you'd like to put to the author of Get the Happiness Habit, How to Mend a Broken Heart, Too Young to get Old? I mean, Christine, we've worked together for a few years now. Admittedly, well, not many years.
You know more about me than I know, I sometimes think.
Well, that's really not as long as I've known Jonathan, but there we are. Jonathan, any questions you'd like to put to Christine?
Well, I think what you just said a little bit earlier on was very interesting. When you said you had your job to look after your partner, And I think that's one of the things that you don't, or I wasn't prepared for, which is the loss of the job.
Yes.
And suddenly you don't have that job anymore. You don't.
Yeah.
And that is a shock, or it was a shock for me. So I thought that was a very interesting phrase. There was another phrase that I wanted to share with you. I don't know if I read in a book about bereavement from a chap who'd lost his partner, and he said when he got home, he felt like he was camping out in the wreckage of his life.
That's a wonderful phrase.
I thought that was an amazing phrase, because it is like that, because you're sleeping in a strange bed. It feels like everything is different.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fairly amazing. I have to confess, I'm very sorry, but I haven't read your book.
It doesn't even come out till Thursday.
but I will make the effort to read it when it does come out. Because I think the positive side of this is that there is a positive side, and that I've recognised that there are a lot of friends and things like that who've become very important in my life, more than I realised they would. And I think that losing a partner is never easy, but it's eased by sharing those experiences with someone else. So I very much admire that you've put down, or you've spoken from the heart in a book, which I think is an extraordinarily brave thing to do, apart from anything else. I think that's
wonderful. I don't know, in a way, it's a sort of processing it yourself. But funnily enough, I was talking to a friend who actually provided the cover quote for the book, who is a psychiatrist and he writes for the Daily Mail. And I said, 10 years ago, I would probably have written a self-help book at this point, about my experiences and what have you. But writing it as fiction is so liberating, because you can actually be more extreme in the feelings and attribute them to somebody else. And I think there's a rawness in a way that you would never have in a self-help book. And I hope that, obviously there are loads of themes in the book. There's new romance, grandchildren, step families, there's all sorts of things. But I hope for people that have lost somebody, they will kind of recognise some of the moments, and it will resonate with them, but in a way that they can kind of relate to, but not be destroyed by, be uplifted almost by, because it's sort of, I think one of the things, and I'm sure you went through this, you sort of think, do other people think this, or am I going completely mad?
Mm.
And I think that one of the things I've tried to do in the book is show that, we have these completely off-center thoughts, but no, you're not going mad. This is pretty common, but it's just that, it's hard to talk about.
No, I get that completely. I mean, for me anyway, there was a huge element of guilt. Guilt about not being able to save her life, or do anything about that to ease the pain. Guilt about or regret, I suppose, are things left unsaid.
I know.
And also the guilt of then smiling, laughing, and enjoying myself, because I felt guilty that people would think I was not respecting the love that we had or that we shared. And in fact,
that those are themes which actually are explored. I mean, initially I was thinking, once again, am I the target audience here? Maybe, maybe not. I do like Christine's writing, so great. When it actually arrived in the post, I devoured it literally over a couple of days. I know that the European Championships and marking final pieces of work at the University of Lincoln. It's amazing. Still, at least I was avoiding sort of any of the cakes, which is important. And the quote, of course, which you were referring to, Christine, by Max Pemberton, of course, a poignant and insightful tale of widowhood and other challenges of later life, which really resonated with Max's clinical experience. And again, very much, I think that the techniques of actually using multiple points of view that you share with the reader, that kind of overlap the narratives, that initially it probably takes about the first 60 or 70 pages before you get your head around who is who, to sort out your Lucy from your Jen, your Helen from other folk. But I can see that kind of crossing over in a number of ways. But it is a richly rewarding read. And certainly I'd say when it is released on June the 17th, it's well worth actually getting a hold of a copy, because it is superb. Even for yourself, young Rory, having just given you 20 minutes advice earlier today about how to use a music program on radio in your latest routine as a recent graduate, or soon to be graduate. I think the technical term now is you're a graduand until the official graduation ceremony from the University of Lincoln. Right.
Not what I've heard of, Alex, but yeah, graduand. Sounds a bit strange, but yeah, here
it's
I
only
am.
A short period of time you're a graduand up to the moment when effectively you get your final piece of paper, then you are a graduate.
Well, what happens to you is that you're a graduand, so you're a part of the university, but you become a member of the university. So the phrase that's used when you graduate is that you're admitted to the university, because up to that point you're just a student. So that's quite. So when you're admitted,
those are
you become.
Things you learn when you come on your programs,
I'd like to include that the message is still there. I mean, Gabrielle, a year or so's time, this will be your own experience that you work through as well, which is great stuff.
It will be.
Anyway, Rory, any thoughts from your own point of view for either, again, Christine or Jonathan?
Well, of course, I don't know if this perspective is discussed in the book. The book is not out, and unfortunately, I have not read it. But thankfully, this is not an experience that I have been through yet. I'm fortunately quite young. My parents are in their 50s, so not quite as chronologically gifted, you know, as many others. But I will always remember when my granddad passed away and my dad having to sit down and tell me and my brother that. And my dad isn't a very emotional person. Like, he's funny, he likes to have a laugh and joke around, but that kind of softer side of him doesn't really come out very often. But watching him struggle to tell me and my brother that is something that has stuck with me for a very, very long time. And it's something that I don't think I can even comprehend the kind of feeling that he was going through. Because he'll talk for England, but talking about something like that is a lot harder to do, as yourself and Jonathan have put absolutely beautifully. And so, yeah, that's the closest thing I have in terms of perspective on this, but it is something that sticks with me. And I mean, as you said, I can never prepare myself for this sort of thing, but I will be thinking of that.
I think that's really interesting. And I think it's wonderful that your dad was able to kind of expose that emotional side of himself, and because that showed you how much he cared for his own father. And that, I think that's a sort of wonderful kind of role model for you, in a way, that somebody was able to be as honest and reveal that bit of himself. I think that was a very loving thing to do, both for his father and also with you and your brother.
Oh, thank Gabriella, you. Thank you very much.
Gabriella, from your own experience, of course, you've got share with us once again your particular genealogy, because it's a wonderful multifaceted genealogy which is currently abiding in Norwich.
Yeah, so luckily, like Rory, I haven't gone through the loss of my parents or anything, but my grandparents in Colombia, my grandfather, he died a few years ago, and he lives in Colombia in South America. So obviously I haven't got to see him as much as I'd like. And obviously we used to do video calls and things like that, but obviously that's not the same. But just with me, my mum's been very open, like she's a very emotional person. And I think for her, because she didn't get to see her father, you know, so like the rest of us, she was really emotional in telling me, I remember, sort of like, you know, tears rolling down her eyes, I remember. And I was quite young. I was about 16, just finished GCSEs. So I wasn't, you know, I think what you were talking about, Jonathan, earlier, that guilt, there was just sort of a guilt there in me. You know, I didn't really know him as I'd like to, I think. But, you know, I was just really thankful that I got to know him before that he passed away.
Guilt is so much part of that kind of grieving process, isn't it? You know, people are guilty about all sorts of things, usually quite misplaced guilt, actually. But it's just one of those things you kind of face, isn't it, really, in the process?
So, Christine, will there be a sequel? Will we find out what happens to these characters when they've left Norwich? I know, Gabrielle, it's a tough call, but, you know, they've had it. Oh, actually, no, one has travelled to Norwich, I believe.
One's gone back to the city of her childhood, which is Norwich, which is what a lot of people do as they get older. You know, they feel the pull of where their roots are. So, yeah. Who knows, Alex?
Well, you know, it could happen. I mean, also from the authorial point of view, that sense of omniscience you have as the creator of these characters. I mean, did you feel any guilt whatsoever about what you were putting Lucy through? I just put that out there, you know, in terms of, you know, I know she had a somewhat louche existence, and you could say, oh, yes, even the very name Lucy, it's like Lucy Harker from Dracula. Morals, etc. Because, I mean, she really, I mean, just for going through a few cakes, even from her wobbling chins in the opening segment of the whole piece, I think, wow, she's not going to end well.
Well, I mean, these are the health messages, you know, that people ignore. And as you know, I've been a health journalist for a very, very, very long time. So it's not surprising that these things come into the fiction, because so often you look at people's lifestyles, people that you love, people you really care for, and you just think, why don't you sort that? You know, there are so many illnesses and things that people get that are nothing to do with how they've lived, and it's just fate, if you like. But there are so many of the kind of so-called aging illnesses, like a lot of heart trouble, many cancers, type 2 diabetes, that you should at least be trying to meet the NHS halfway. Frankly, you should be doing your bit. You can't expect to live in that way and then have them put it right. That's not how it works. So I think it was quite important to have a character actually who was not prepared to try, you know, really.
Yeah, well, we do have the strap line for the station, of course, sugar is the new nicotine. So I should say, you know, so it's very important to work through that. Okay. Jonathan, anything you'd like to put to Christine about life, the universe, so many ways of loving? I mean, I got it interesting. It did sort of wrap me up in terms of, was there a kind of sense of channeling Stan Barstow's A Kind of Loving from the 1960s new wave element? Or was that a case of, no, that's going off on another tangent?
Yes, the latter.
That's okay.
Well, I'm with Christine on the health messages thing. I think it's absolutely vitally important that people stay well. And a lot of my friends are now reaching that point in their lives. I'm in my mid-60s and my friends are anywhere sort of late 50s to late 60s. And some of the chickens are coming home to roost about how they lived their lives earlier. So I suppose the message needs to go out. Don't have a miserable time. Don't spend your whole time being too healthy and working out in the gym and being obsessive. But I'm totally with Christine on this one, that I think if people just had a little bit of sense and didn't smoke and didn't eat too much sugar and lived a bit healthier and walked a bit during the day instead of driving or sitting in front of
commuters. Stop those bake-off programs now.
Well, but it is true, isn't it, that every time you turn on the television, there's a cooking show. I mean, all the time, and they cook with all the wrong sorts of food. Yeah. It's terrible. It's terrible.
No, I'm so with you. I mean, I really feel very strongly about people taking responsibility and just even doing, you know, just making small changes to start with can lead to big changes.
And of course, a whole range of wonderful podcasts, hashtag too young to get old. I mean, Christine, although we've known each other for a few years, it's all been kind of through the telephonic medium, etc. It's the first time you've actually been part of the visual Zoom world.
I know, it's exciting, isn't it?
There you go. So switching your broadcasting skill sets to obviously producing a regular podcast on basically 5 or 10 minutes worth of thoughts and so on. How have you found that? Was that something which you thought, yeah, I'm going to embrace this new technology as opposed to step aside from it?
Yeah, I think partly that. The woman that helps me, well, does really, my website, because I'm not, you know, very talented in that direction. She said to me, you should be doing video podcasts. You know, you could do it. And to begin with, I put a cameraman and a sound man and this, that, the other, and did it. You know, could I have extra lighting keys? And then the pandemic happened, and I thought, well, I think I'm going to just learn, oh, there's a camera in there, I could do that, you know, perhaps I'll put an angle poise here, an angle poise. I've played around with it a bit. And now, of course, I, you know, I can make them whenever I feel like it. I don't have to make five in a go to make it viable economically. I just sort of think, right, I'll think I'll do something about friendship today, and I just do it. And actually, I think I'm more relaxed when I'm just doing it myself, you know, without a crew there. And I never have to say to the cameraman afterwards, you know, I think I'm really looking my age in here. Could you not have done something? So now it's down to me and the camera and the machine, and that's it, really.
Exactly. And Christine, you can do so much fun stuff. You can even actually change your background. You can actually spin people around. You can have all sorts of
other. Listen, I'm never going to be this adventurous. So, yeah.
It's just worth considering, because it puts you into all sorts of ways from that point of view. But
hanging upside down certainly has its appeal, as you.
It's a metaphor for my life, Christine. I won't go any further.
Oh, really. Stop. Yeah.
Gabriella, any closing thoughts from yourself, apart from obviously you need to get hold of So Many Ways of Loving by Christine Weber, out and available presumably in all the usual good stores and indeed online as well.
Well, it'll certainly be in Gerald's, so which is the Norwich bookshops.
I will definitely get the book, most definitely, because it's something that I'd really like to read about, actually. And if I just could put one last thing to Christine and Jonathan and Rory. So is there any advice that you would give to people sort of going through bereavement at the moment, particularly with the pandemic? Because, I mean, obviously, there's been, you know, I mean, a complete, like, loneliness sort of, you know, with the bereavement. So what kind of advice would you give?
You guys have the floor for this, because you're way more qualified than I am.
Well, I would say, in fact, I've written on this quite a bit, you really need to make the effort to be seeing people, even if, it, you know, during the lockdowns we couldn't actually be with people. But I used to say to people, well, you just have to get your head around Zooming or whatever and make sure that you're talking, either on the phone, but preferably visually, WhatsApp or whatever, two or three times a day, because that's when you feel much more real and that flow of conversation gives you a perspective and it brightens your day. And it's really important that people don't become too isolated, and whether it's through grief or whether it's through, you know, just illness and everything, we must always remember that, you know, a certain amount of solitude is good for the soul, but really not all day, and certainly not all day every day. It plays with your mind in a bad way. And so you need to reach out, and particularly if people are not dropping in because they're not allowed to or haven't been, then find another way of communicating. It is just vital.
Jonathan.
Well, I would have said two things I think are quite important. One is, don't rush into any major life-changing decisions straight after you're bereaved, because they won't necessarily be good ones. No. And I would also add to that, if you're bereaved and you want to talk to your the person you're bereaved from, there's nothing wrong with talking to them and asking their advice. And quite often they'll give you the answer, which I found very useful.
I think that's so true.
Yeah.
I think that's so true. I had to say to my stepsons, you know, don't ring me on Fridays at 8 ever, because that was the time and the day when my husband died. And I always have a little date night. And I used to say to my stepsons, it is a bit one-sided. I'm doing all the talking, but as David would have said, nothing new there then. And I light a candle for him at that time. And I mean, I do talk to him all the time, but that's my special time. And as you say, sometimes your mind is just clearer, isn't it, afterwards? You know,
absolutely.
You feel that person is still looking out for you. And I think that's a very reassuring and lovely thing.
No, I think it's wonderful. Yeah. I think I was just going to say can I just say to Gabriella that if she wanted to talk to her grandfather, then she should. That's what ask questions and see what he answers. See what you think he would have answered, which is quite fascinating, actually. And and it, you'll explore some of your own feelings as a result of that, I think.
Looking for answers from within and echoing the notion that we are indeed spiritual beings on a human journey, as opposed to the reverse of that. This is National Smile Month, so happy National Smile Month. We focused that out with the British Oral Association earlier in this particular programme. We've also had some Elton John music, for reasons which, if you get So Many Ways of Loving, you'll see the Rocket Man connection there without any much ado whatsoever. In fact, we're going out with I'm Still Standing. But Jonathan, would you like to, in your capacity as head boy / senior co-presenter for this midweek drive, would you like to put the two final questions to the team, please?
Yes. So to Christine, to Rory and to Gabrielle, have you had a good time being on this interview podcast, whatever it is?
Or even a reasonably interesting Zoomer.
Or a reasonably, a Zoomer, which obviously doesn't make great radio, but it's good on camera. And yeah. And would you come back again and talk to everybody again? So please go
ahead. Yes. Thank you very much. Please invite me. And I've had a wonderful time. Thank you.
Excellent.
Oh, always. I'm always missing Alex's really obscure 60s references and his beautiful sense of humour. And I'm sure I would absolutely love to be back. Yeah.
Excellent.
Gabriella, I mean, I was just teaching you online this last academic year. I mean, really obscure 60s references. I think we made some focused notion in what we call Origins of Modern Britain, or indeed Histories of Journalism.
We did, yeah. I remember your references to the Beatles as well. That was great.
And
the Man from Uncle, of course.
Some of you may have heard of them. Okay, Jonathan, has it been good for you?
Fantastic. Thanks, Alex. As always, lovely to see you. Lovely to meet some wonderful new people. And I hope to see you again at some point.
Brilliant stuff. Okay. Don't forget, So Many Ways of Loving, Christine Weber. You can also go to christineweber.com in terms of fantastic book, fantastic text, to Gabriella Van Genien's, Rory McGowan and Jonathan Lindsley. And of course, Christine Weber, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on. And yes, it is National Smile Month, so keep smiling.
It's just like ice, and there's a cold and lonely light that shines from you. You wind up like the wreck you hide behind that mask you use. And did you think this fool could never win? Well, look at me, I'm coming back again. I got a taste of love in a simple way. And if you need to know while I'm still standing, you just fade away. Don't you know I'm still standing better than I ever did? Looking like a true survivor, feeling like a little kid. And I'm still standing after all this time, picking up the pieces of my life without you on my mind. I'm still standing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm still standing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Once I never could have hoped to win, you're starting down the road leaving me again. You made were meant to cut me down. And if my love was just a circus, you'd be a clown by